You have to create your own industry and your own audience that is going to give a shit about you and your movies. No one will care about your movie as much as you do. You should act that way.
There's a lot of things sort of that I want to dive into, but I always like to just start with, like, what are you doing right now? Like, what's kind of your zone right now, and in terms of directing and acting, and like, what are you kind of into right now?
I am acting in a movie, a feature by a first time feature filmmaker in October in Palmdale. So not too far away. And that's the first real time I'm acting in a movie that I'm not writing and directing and I'm the lead in. So that's different for me. And then we've written two features that I really like, but I don't know if anybody's going to give us any money to make them. It's still kind of a slog to go through Hollywood to get anybody to engage with something. And the only success that we've had has been releasing two movies in the last 3 years, and then celebrities reaching out and saying, hey, I really dug that movie. I saw it on Netflix or whatever. Yeah. And then them luckily being perfect for characters in the scripts that we've written, and then they sign on, and then everybody wants to come on and help out with the movie. But it's still one of those things of, like, we're not trying to make enormously expensive movies, and we're still not getting any help. And so I'm kind of in this position of, well, we just spent the last movie making fun of Hollywood pretty hardcore. Why did I think that anything was going to change, you know?
Yeah. It's funny how talent seems to be the crux of a lot of whether a movie gets made or not.
Yeah.
Especially as a director, I think you really do notice sort of the impact from, like, celebrity versus, or not even just celebrity, but just, like, known talent versus, like, you know, the $100,000 movie you made with your friends. You know what I mean? Did you experience any of that coming out of festivals and stuff with, like, Beta Test or Thunder Road or anything, like, were people sort of biding for your next thing?
No. I never really had anybody bide for my next thing. There's this weird, like, misinformation that I think gets spread amongst young filmmakers, where if you have a short film and you're going to a big festival, you have to have some screenplay ready. You're like, people are going to ask you, well, what are you doing next? What do you have next? And that's just not true, really. Like, a lot of it is just about packaging and, like, talent being attached. So, like, if you can convince somebody through DMing them that they should be in your feature, immediately the conversation gets started that the movie's going to get made. Yeah. Rather, it doesn't matter what shorts you've made before. So yeah, I mean, no, short answer. And I'm still in that position of, like, I can have a feature that I researched for 2 years, longer than anything we've done before, and then still have nobody want to help out.
Yeah.
It's a really strange marketplace right now.
Did you feel that way coming out of the short run of Thunder Road? And, like, maybe tell me the story of how that got turned into a feature so quickly.
Yeah, sure. So I was a producer at College Humor, and I was making, like, two sketches a week as a line producer, just, like, budgeting and scheduling these sketches. And then I made the Thunder Road short film in a single day on a Saturday. It's one shot, so it kind of had to be a single day. We made it that way because we didn't have any money. It was easier and cheaper to do it that way. And so we shot it and then submitted it to Sundance, and then it got in and won. And then for, like, 7 months, I did the water bottle tour around Hollywood and met a bunch of really wonderful people that continued to do the thing that we made fun of in the beta test of, well, let's keep talking.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're excited. Oh, my God, we're so excited. And really, bless their hearts. They're all in this machine, and they don't know how to, you know, make anything and then rely on people like us to make stuff. And so for a long time, I thought we couldn't turn it into a feature. And then I had the idea to do it, the short film would be the opening scene of the feature rather than the climax. And then I wrote it in, like, 6 days or something like that. And somebody that I met kind of on the water bottle tour, my buddy Zach Parker, came on and said, well, I would love to help out. The short is really meaningful to me. Let's do it. And then we ran a Kickstarter campaign because we couldn't get anybody to take us seriously. And we applied to grants. We did all the stuff that you'd think you should do to make a $190,000 feature film. and a lot of help. Vanishing Angle, Natalie Metzger, and Matt Miller were always there to support, and they did six of my single take short films before we did the feature. So I had been practiced and kind of ready to make something that was longer form. And then we made it, and then it won South by Southwest, and I'd already written The Wolf of Snow Hollow as a web series for another company. Nobody trusted me to make a feature. I'd never made a feature before. I was only good in web series and sketches and stuff. And then as soon as we won South by Southwest, the people who had rejected the web series of Wolf of Snow Hollow were like, what's going on with this werewolf thing? I would love to. Oh my God, I loved it. When we were working on it, I loved that. Even though I rejected it in this same email chain, I loved it. It was great. And so then we had some clout because of South by Southwest and getting into Cannes that that was a viable project. And then we got that greenlit within a week. So it's good to hear that you say, like, how did that get done so fast? It was still just through Kickstarter. It had nothing to do with Hollywood or any of the established channels that I had built over those 7 months.
Did you feel like it was maybe, I don't know if there's like some actual metric of like, you need to be proven this many times where like you, like Thunder Road, the short does really well. You went for the feature and like, okay, now we like believe in you. You know
no,
what I mean?
That like, never happens. And also like the way that the industry works from all this research that we did for the beta test, the whole way that the industry talks to creatives is to make them feel inadequate in 1,000 different ways. And so even if you win the Palme d'Or or something like that, their goal is to say, well, you know, I mean, the script is good. It needs some work. And like all of this kind of bizarre psychological warfare against creatives so that they can control them, so that they are subordinates rather than the competition. And it's really disturbing. I think we all know that. Like when we say Hollywood, we know that that is what that means, that it is this bizarre system that we all live in. And so it was very important for me to circumvent it. It has not become easier as a 3-time feature filmmaker. And we've got good scoreboard. Like a lot of our films have been very well reviewed and loved, and we've made, you know, they've all been in the black and as films. That never happens for an independent filmmaker. We've been very, very lucky. And even now it's difficult. There are people who are really wonderful that are executives where I'll knock on the door and say, hey, I'm really struggling here. I really want to get y'all this movie. And they'll go, I didn't even know that. Okay, send us the script. Just text it to me or whatever. So in that sense, it's become a lot easier to get past the gatekeeping and the gates in general. But even now, it's funny, we're like, we made a movie making fun of gatekeepers in Hollywood, and I'm still thinking, I have to get approval from these people, from the Tuxedos, in order to get anything made. And it's just not true.
Yeah. Do you prefer one way or the other? Because, like, Wolf of Snow Hollow was, I think, like a $2 million, $3 million movie.
Yeah.
And you've sort of cut your teeth on these, like, really small movies. Like, what is sort of the biggest difference to you in approach and, like, I think some of the obvious stuff is that you get with money is obvious, but what are some of the more like intangible stuff that you maybe picked up?
So like just practically for The Wolf of Snow Hollow, we had 5 days to mix the film at a professional vendor in Hollywood, which is not very much time to mix a 83-minute movie. I could have done it for 50 days, basically. And that was because of the deadlines and the studio systems and what we were able to budget for post-production. Whereas with the beta test, I had 44 days of mixing because I learned the mixing software and we bought speakers from Guitar Center because they have a 45-day return policy, no questions asked. And so we made a 5.1 system kind of like this in my garage and we were able to forensically get in and make the movie, I think, a more cinematic experience than Wolf of Snow Hollow is because there's actual time spent making the thing. So practically, because I was able to make that post schedule, the movie just ends up becoming a better movie, I think,
totally.
Or at least a more cinematic movie. So practically, that's the cleanest way that I can say it. And then with notes, it's difficult because there are times when you're working with the studio, I'm like the biggest diplomat of all time. I will take notes, I will listen, I'll do all that stuff. And then we'll have a test screening and then you listen to the public. They're gonna be much better at giving notes than people who have never edited a YouTube video before. Yeah. And I try to be nice, I'm always nice. I say that now because I'm being recorded. But But it is a really difficult thing to get anything through that system that's good. We're very lucky to have any great movie or a fantastic movie. Like Severance gets made and you're like, how the hell did that get so specific? It's so fantastic and well put together. Oh, he was really famous. That's how he did it.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard of music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. From indie artists on the rise to leading composers, MusicBed has curated the best roster of musicians for your films. Go to musicbed.com and use the promo code EPISODE4 to get your first month free on a standard subscription. That's episode F-O-U-R at musicbed.com.
It's funny how like, because I earlier in 2020, made a 14-day, $100,000 movie. There is a massive difference in that range from just like $100,000 to like $190,000.
Yeah.
It's like not that much more money, but I think it's like what it gives you is just like one or two more things that you sort of get to play with. But I think what you said, like,
well, sleep as you get to sleep at night rather than like, how do I make sure that tomorrow happens? If you, the less money that you have, and it's exponential, like $130,000 is so much more relaxing than a $100,000 movie. I'm lucky. I was a producer on a $35,000 movie that we shot for 10 days called 13 Cameras in a backyard, and we all camped out in tents. But then that movie went on to gross $1 million or whatever. It was a slasher movie. And so like that was the first thing that any of my friend group from college came together to make. It was 2015, 2014.
I think the audience like has probably never really heard the description of how distribution like gets acquired and like how it actually like the battle of like
criminally
like, can you tell me what the MG was from Gravitas for that $35,000 movie?
I actually don't know. So I was
a
producer on that one. I know that they have, and also it's mailbox money for me. So like every couple of months I get a check in the mail that's like, oh my God, this movie we made in 2014 is still doing well. So it did, and it was very lucrative for the investors, I'm told. But then with Thunder Road, the same thing of like, because we made it for 190, I think the movie's grossed like 750K, maybe $1 million since it came out all over the world. Distribution is interesting. Distribution has changed so much in the last 8 years where you can use an aggregator to get onto any of the platforms that you can think of like iTunes, Google Play, Steam, Xbox, like any of the places that people watch or rent movies.
As opposed to a sales agent, you mean?
As opposed to a sales agent, you can just go to an aggregator like BitMax and upload your movie and it shows up on the iTunes store and on Apple Trailers almost the same way that any other movie has. Yeah. And that's something that I feel like most filmmakers don't know or aren't told in their education because they need to be subordinates.
Yeah.
They can't be the competition.
Yeah. What was it like sort of dealing with, was it Orion?
Orion Pictures.
Yeah. What was it like trying to keep your, because I'm dealing with this currently right now, I'm hoping you can give me some advice. What was it like trying to keep your vision with like posters, trailers, key art, did they kind of take that away a little bit?
I was lucky because the executives were young and cool enough that they had good taste. I know filmmakers that do not have that luck. One of the executives was my age. He used to work at Sony and then went to Orion and is still a buddy. Like he was a guy who, like, when we were trying to heat up the hot tub in Wolf of Snow Hollow, was carrying pots of boiling water for the actors. Like, this guy is my dude. Anyway. But no, I was very lucky in that sense. They had existing friendly vendors that were doing posters, and some of them were awful. Some of them were a joke how bad they were. It was like they had never seen the movie and they're like, oh, let's make a kid's book out of this poster. And I was like, no, please, it's gotta be cool. But because I was the writer, actor, and director, I've said this before, I was much harder to deal with, or I was much more of a liability than if I was just the director. If I was just the director could be disinvited from the editing room.
It's interesting. Yeah.
But because I was the writer, actor, and director, the microphone ended up in my face at the end of the day. And I think there was a turning point in the post-production where I made that apparent just on a Zoom call or something where I was like, I'm going to say bad stuff unless we get to, unless the movie's good. Like, it doesn't help anybody that the movie's cheesy. We can't do that. And so I stopped getting notes, and then we were able to finish the movie properly for like the last 2 months, and it was great. The movie turned out really well.
Yeah. That's so funny. I guess I didn't realize that. I mean, cause you're going to be seeing your face on this thing for the rest of eternity, where it's, but you're also directing it.
It's an identity crisis. Totally. It is like really stressful. And when someone is coming in who ends up not even working at the company in 2 months because of how quick the turnover is in Hollywood, they don't care. They're just giving notes in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And then I have to live with it for the rest of my life. And the movie, because I wrote it and directed it and acted in it, is me. So when the movie's getting made fun of on the internet, it's not the executives that come on. All of this David Fincher went through. Like, whenever I feel stressed about Hollywood, I always watch David Fincher interviews from like post Alien 3. Yeah. But he says, if the movie, this was on Gone Girl in an interview, but he says, if the movie is really good, I'll get more credit than I deserve. And if the movie is really bad, I'll get more credit than I deserve.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is one of those things that I've been very lucky. The movies that we've made have turned out very good.
Are there directors that are in your canon that you sort of...
Uncle Dave is like the top. David Fincher is like one of my absolute favorite filmmakers. I've been very lucky. David and Sion Chaffin, his partner and producer, were some of the first people to see the beta test. I was sending it to people like film festivals and stuff. And then I was like, the sound design isn't working. I don't know if this movie works. I don't know if like A plus B equals C, does the last act work? And then like sent it to David Gordon Green because I was in Halloween Kills, and he's been a pen pal for 8 years. So I thought, he's such a wonderful human being. But he watched it and was like, this works, I would move this around, and like gave actual editing notes that were fantastic. And then I've been so lucky that like people watch my movies on an airplane and then will land and reach out and call me. So like if I ever need help on how do I get this visual effect to work? What am I missing here? I can actively email somebody and they'll respond very quickly. It's so weird to me. Like, I'll email some hero of mine and be like, I don't want to take up any of your time. Please, I just need help with this one thing. And then they're like, within 5 minutes, they're like, here's the fix. It's crazy.
Don't you find that the sort of higher level people are the more generous with their time for some reason?
I don't think that's an accident. I think that sometimes you get there because... being nice and considerate in this industry is so rare.
Yeah.
As a producer for 6 years before I ever wrote and directed anything or acted anything, I worked with directors who were just like sometimes nightmares on sets. And I was like, I never want to create this experience for anybody, any member of crew. And so I'm kind of privileged in that sense. I got to work with a bunch of directors who were inconsiderate. And then I was like, all right, we can't do this. This is not the way that I want the film industry to be 10 years from now.
Yeah. Can you sort of analyze your sets now? Like, do you have sort of techniques and things that you like to bring to a set?
Yeah. How our sets are different from maybe other directors or film sets. It feels much more like a summer camp. And then every time I say that, I realize like all of my favorite filmmakers create that same environment on their set. So that's not entirely different.
How do you make it feel that way though?
So because of the budgets, usually we all live very close to each other. For Wolf of Snow Hollow, we took out this giant Airbnb farmhouse in Camas, Utah, and we all shared a kitchen. It was like everybody was hanging out. There's like art department and cinematography team, and like we were all kind of living together. It was a great experience that happened to be this giant MGM movie. And then with the sets, practically, we have an open video village. So like, it's not quarantined off or above the line. Anybody and any department can come in and watch the movies. Yeah. And we've been very lucky that the last three movies we've done have had long takes in them, which is the most collaborative and fun experience you can ever have on a film set. Like opening it up to art department and production assistants and anybody who's visiting. When you watch playback of something that we all worked hard to get, it is like scoring a touchdown as a team.
Yeah.
And it is so fulfilling, and you're laughing and you're crying with the team. It is like the reason that we make movies this way. So in that sense, we're different, that we are like very collaborative and inviting of everybody. It's an education experience for everybody. Like, I learned how to do this stuff from being on other people's sets. Right. It's important to pass that down.
Totally. What's it like winning Sundance with your short?
I suggest everybody do it.
Sure.
It was really wild. It's strange because it was also very well documented. Like,
I remember, yeah.
There was so much footage of it.
And what was the name of the, so people can find it, the short that you guys made alongside the, what was it called?
It's called Sundance 2016, all one word.
Yeah.
It's on Vimeo. I think it's called Winning Sundance on YouTube or Vimeo. You can find it, but it was this, you know, we got into Sundance and we didn't know anybody that had ever gotten into the festival. Right. It was like this glass castle in the sky, and we knew nothing about it. We hadn't seen short films. At that time, the only time you could see something was like Short of the Week. Like, I couldn't afford the tickets to go to Park City. I couldn't go and see the shorts program, but I had seen stuff for Short of the Week, and I was like, oh, these people have a fucking sense of humor. I could do something humiliating and submit and maybe get in. And we did. But then we got in, and my buddy Dustin Hahn and my buddy PJ McCabe were like, okay, well, this festival is all about like pomp and circumstance, and everybody is like, you know, the ceremony of this whole thing. It's like, let's go and do this fake documentary about Jim becoming addicted to cocaine and like living the high life in like the 3 days that we're there. And so we were filming this like bullshit fake documentary. And then we went to the ceremony and won the grand jury prize. Yeah. And so by accident, it was this like unprecedented access to the festival and what it was like to win Sundance, all wrapped up in this bullshit web series that we were doing. But basically, we convinced Filmmaker Magazine to let us release them as episodes. We're like, we're going to go and do it. And for the first two episodes, they were like, oh, this is a documentary. This is just, Jim's just a weird guy these days. And then when like me freebasing cocaine got into it, they were like, hold on a second. I don't know if we can release this stuff. It was really funny. They were cool. But no, it was exhilarating. And it's weird to watch that footage of me and the team getting struck by lightning, basically. It was like,
Dude, that moment really does make me emotional.
It's wild.
Because everything up until there is really funny, and you're like, oh, these guys are kind of having a goof. And then it's like the first like really real moment where you guys have true sort of just like
break character.
You just break character. And I think you guys were like sitting down or something.
Yeah, it's in a bowling alley.
Just like collapsed.
Yeah. Maybe,
and you're just like,
oh, I had no idea. Well, also, circumstantially, I was a producer for 6 years. I knew I was a good actor. I knew I could do it if I wanted to, or if I tried. And I really tried. I really worked my ass off on that short film. I rehearsed it for 2 months. So all this baggage of like feeling inadequate and less than, and never knowing if we'd ever make it in Hollywood. I went to film school, and then all the, basically everything that every filmmaker goes through for 10 years trying to make stuff. And then we won, and it was just this thing of like, oh, now the spotlight is on us for whatever reason. It's basically everybody's dream to have these accolades, to be celebrated by this enormous arts festival. And it was really cool. And then you go to the VIP section, there are other winners there, and you're like, what are you working on these days? And they go, not much. And it's like, oh, okay, that's kind of grounding. And from that night after the VIP section, I was like, I can't do that. I have to, I can't listen to the people that are going to say, you're going to be great, things will work out. I have to make them work out.
Yeah.
And then I just continued to work that hard and raced at hard work, whatever that was going to be. And that became the three features that we've made over the last 5 years.
Did it make it any special, more special that, I think it was Keegan-Michael Key.
Yeah.
Was like,
well, that's coming from like
the comedy world.
The way that it works is that year they programmed 72 short films out of 7,900 that got submitted.
It's crazy.
So it's like, you know, it's easier to get into Harvard twice than it is to win Sundance. And so we were lucky enough that the programmers thought that we were valuable, that the short was valuable or good. And then they have nothing to do with what the jury decides. So the jury just gets shipped in and sits down in the theater and watches the thing. And we were so lucky that Keegan-Michael Key happened to be one of the jurors that year, because this is a guy who has danced and done ridiculous shit for comedic and dramatic purposes. And so like, if we had been the next year, it's possible we wouldn't have won anything.
Sure.
It really is a crapshoot when it comes to these things. So like, being the center of the Venn diagram, it is so insane. It still feels like it didn't happen. Like,
yeah,
there's that, it feels like I'm in this universe, in the multiverse system, and this one thing is different, and it happened to be that we got struck by lightning in Park City. And then to have it happen again at South by Southwest with the feature, and to get into Cannes, and then like, I think I'm very lucky. I was a Redditor for 13 years, and so like, I understand how audiences appreciate comedy and drama, what they actually find interesting. And that became my kind of metronome of what was going to work in film. I still think that that is a very valuable thing that I did and do too much. But yeah, I feel like really just trying to impress your heroes and being ambitious at a young age and having these small benchmarks of like trying to get staff picked on Vimeo, trying to make something that is going to be socially and culturally significant and working your fucking ass off. Can I curse? Is that okay?
Of course.
I just realized that was the first F-bomb I had. but really trying to make something, those things are valuable. Those things will help you to level up and to help your dreams come true.
Yeah.
So I'm very lucky that I came about at that time when staff picks and like, Short of the Week were prevalent, and I could educate myself on what was good.
Yeah.
You know?
It's so crazy. Just, I mean, because a lot of people would just say getting into Sundance is like the one of the hardest things to do. I mean,
it is.
It is statistically like kind of impossible.
Oh, and we've submitted stuff, and we've submitted Beta Test and Wolves Know How, and they were like, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Or like, not this year or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Didn't you get in with another short the next year?
The Robbery. Yeah.
That's so crazy, dude.
Yeah.
Is also another one take sort of longer.
Yeah.
It's like a 10 minute.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
Another great short. I'm wondering if there was some kind of analysis of like, were you trying to hit lightning again with another sort of one take thing? Like coming off of
The short. That was the only thing that we could get financing to make. And so we made six more single take short films, and then Topic came along and financed three more. So before I made the Thunder Road feature, I made nine more single take short films that are out there. You can watch them.
Was The Robbery truly one take?
Yeah.
There's no cuts? Okay.
It's funny, we're like, I mean, that's why I did it. I saw Children of Men a bunch of times in theaters when it came out, and I was in film school at the time, and I had been a huge fan of like Tarkovsky, and Stalker was one of my favorite movies. And I was like, oh, I wonder if you could do this in the modern day. And like True Detective did that one episode that has a long take in it. And like, I was like, oh man, it's kind of cool. And it's like impressive. My background was in hand-drawn animation. And the thing with animation is like the audience is just in awe of how much work went into it.
Yeah, of course.
And it's the same thing with long takes, where we wanted to have the audience say, I can't believe they did that.
Mm.
And that was the easiest transition into live action narrative for me, was doing it in long takes.
Why do you think that Thunder Road as the feature, also the short, is like kind of a special thing? Like, why do you think it really just like nailed that moment in time?
I've had a lot of time to think about it. It's been 6 years since that we did the movie, the short of Thunder Road. And I think it is because it's the center of the Venn diagram of, it is like a Pixar movie in that it is trying to make the audience laugh and cry and does it seemingly seamlessly, kind of, all of the moves are hidden. It's all one shot. All the editing was done beforehand. It's like Alan Partridge style comedy and humiliation pornography and like Sacha Baron Cohen cringe and, you know, Ricky Gervais, David Brent. It's all of these different heroes of mine that went into doing this thing. And then it's also a very famous song that's highly copywritten that I think people were like, oh, this is subversive, taboo artwork.
Totally.
I think also because it was one shot, it was incredibly impressive, where people would say, I can't believe this guy did that. And then the cinematography was so fantastic because Drew Daniels, who shot Krisha and a lot of Euphoria, it was so thoughtful in the way that it was like suspiciously simple or deceptively simple. And it's also just really funny to watch somebody fall apart. Philosophically and statistically, a lot of Americans say that the two biggest fears they have is death and public speaking.
Yeah.
And to do both of those at the same time, and to have this guy be this goof, this like dumb guy who is only considering mortality and life and his place in the universe at the very last moment of like, I have to get up and talk about my mom. And then he's like, oh yeah, what is death all about? This is crazy. You know, like, and that's very funny to me. Like, to watch somebody fail very hard at something that we're probably all gonna have to go through is real ammunition to people to say, you're not going to do it that bad. Like, and it's okay. And this guy did it terrible and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Did it feel like the universe just sort of like fell into place when you were making it? Like, or did it like really kind
in
of
in retrospect, that's deceptive. I think that might be like an evolutionary thing in the mind of like, oh, it all kind of came naturally, these things. And I know that feeling of like having made a piece of artwork and you don't remember how fucking miserable it was to make the thing, where you're like, I was boiling hot, I was, you know, hyperventilating, I was sleeping at night. And then you look back and you're like, oh, what a great fun time that was on set. You know?
It's like having a kid where you're just like,
you only remember the nice stuff. It is a weird thing. I think that is evolutionary. I think it's something where like the selective memory that we have, or the past memories that we have of like, oh, we only remember the nice things instead of how hot we were on the Spanish Steps in Rome. I feel like with that film, I'm so reminded of what torture it was to do. It is one of the hardest things I've done. It's 13 minutes and you have to organically cry halfway through. You have to do this complicated dance routine for like an actor's monologue. It is a challenge to do. And I made it that way. I wanted to make something super impressive that would make people surprised that a human is able to do that. Rachmaninoff apparently would do that. His hands were enormous and he would only write music for people that can reach keys, which is really funny. I love that. I was like, I was trying to show off. That was the whole point. I wanted to impress people and get laid. And so I was doing that. So we're all trying to do it.
And now you're married. So
yeah, now it worked out. It worked out perfectly. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. But no, I look back and I'm like, with the Thunder Road feature, I've always had this thing, and I think a lot of artists have this thing of like, I'm going to die soon. I need to get this thing out of me. Yeah. And like, I need to finish the thing and be comfortable that I'm an artist and I made this thing. It's this weird fear of death, but also like desire to get the things out there to spread your seed, basically. And so at any given time, I'm thinking, I'm going to be dead next year. I'm going to be dead in 2 years or whatever. And I've always had that since I was a teenager. And with the Thunder Road feature, it's a suicide letter. It was supposed to be this thing that was going to kill me. We wrote this thing to be impossible to do and to also be this thing that is going to be on my epitaph of like how to best raise a daughter, how to not screw up when a parent dies. It was supposed to be this like digging up of all of this awful stuff that we try to ignore in America and in masculinity and in families. And I wanted to have it out in the world before I died, and now I don't know what I'm still doing here. You ever have that feeling of like when you finish something that's really great, it's like, I did that, now I can go. Oh, I'm still here. You know, what else do I do?
Yeah.
I have all these scars still from Thunder Road of like breaking the glass in the door. Like for months I couldn't lift anything with my right arm above my head. It was like, I was Jackie Chan. I was like getting beat up on every movie and I was loving that. I still do. I want to do that. But the next two movies that I've written, I'm not acting in. It's for other people.
I was going to ask you that. If you're
I'm going to beat up some other people, damage them for life.
How many takes did it take to do Thunder Road?
For the short, it was 6. We had to cut 2 of them short. So it was 8, but we had to cut 2 of them short because I was laughing or people were laughing. And then...
Dude, that's got to suck to get like 7, 8 minutes into it.
Oh my God, it was awful. You get all the way to the end and something happens. You're like, I'm an idiot. And then you have to go back. And then for the feature, it was 18. And we did 9 with the song, like it is in the short film. And then 9 without the song. And I had like time to break for lunch in between. And then the last take was the 18th take that we used. I just looked exhausted. Wow. It looked like I've been crying all night. And I was like, this is probably better for the thing. And the camera and the sound was all perfect. Performance was much better by the end of the day. And it worked out.
18. So I imagine you did that in one day.
Yeah. Maybe, okay. It was the first day of production for the feature.
Yeah.
And immediately everybody that was on the crew and cast that happened to be there was like, I am in this thing. Like it to
did you
see,
do it day one because you wanted to get it out of the way or
I think I don't know. So that was Natalie, my producer's call, Natalie and Ben. I don't know if it was just like we had the church on this day, but I think that was going to be like, this is probably the hardest thing that we have to do. We have to open the movie with this 11-minute thing. Let's kill Jim on day one.
Yeah.
But it was the best decision. It was like, and then basically there was never a moment on those, on that set or any of the future sets where people weren't coming up like in Video Village and putting their arm around me. Like we felt like this big family.
That's cool.
Because they saw me killing myself on screen and they were like, I want to help out.
Yeah. What was it like? I mean, obviously you, we touched on it earlier, but I think going to like a $2 million sort of more studio driven movie, like going back to sort of the grind of a sort of
smaller
budget movie.
No, I really wanted to. So,
does that annoy you, by the way?
It sounds like I'm crying. No, I love making a smaller budget movie.
Does that annoy you when you, I don't know.
We couldn't have done the beta test as a big budget movie. They never would have let us do it.
Yeah.
Hollywood never would have let us do it.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie's about Hollywood. It's about the WGA packaging fight. And I've seen projects that were alienating of Hollywood that then go through the system and they lose their teeth. And it's like the industry is like, oh, we love it. Let's make it more about us and how terrible we are. And it's cutesy.
Yeah.
And we wanted it to be an act of terrorism. The whole point of that movie was to make something that you could not make in the system. It got bought by IFC, some of the coolest fucking movies. Yeah. All of Alfonso's early stuff is on there. Like all of my Death of Stalin, all these other subversive films are through IFC films. We were very lucky, and that was kind of our job to do that. If we had tried to go through the system, we'd be going through exactly what we're doing right now, like writing something. It's ready a year out, but then we just need a bunch of people to convince their bosses that ready to go out.
Yeah. Was IFC like a big thing for you growing up too?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I saw Edward Burns' movies through them. I mean, so many wonderful movies. Y Tu Mamá También. Like,
first movie I ever saw on IFC was Y Tu Mamá También.
It's an unbelievable masterpiece. I think it's so good.
I think it's it's always going to be sort of my, like, at least top five movies of all time.
It's so iconic as a summer movie of, like, youth, childhood. That was certainly my experience growing up as a boy. He's a buddy now, Alfonso.
Is he really?
Which is crazy. Well, he's a pen pal. I'm supposed to hang out with him. He's shooting something right now, but he reached out on Instagram. I'd been bugging him. I was like, hey, man, I love your movies. You're the reason I make movies. And then
Alfonso's on Instagram?
I think so, yeah.
That's funny.
But I said, I think for Roma. I said, hey, what's up? And then months later, he was like, oh, I do like your movie, Thunder Road, but I've also loved your other two movies. We should hang out. And I feel like I had to run around the block. I was like, I got to go for runs. Like, my dream come true. I saw Children of Men in 2007, and I saw it 20 times in the movie theater. Yeah. It's why I am in this room right now, that movie, seeing that movie. It's really wild that like you can make stuff and put it out on the internet. You have no idea who is watching the thing.
Yeah. Dude, so it's funny how like the short of Thunder Road, like, because it is sort of, it's a great origin story, if you will, you know, of like this sort of moment that like creates a lot of catalyst for your career and stuff. But the feature is so good.
Yeah.
And like,
I like the feature more.
Yeah.
Feature of Thunder Road was 14 and a half days, 190 grand. We shot it in Austin, Texas. My buddy Zach Parker is an EP on the film. Said anything that we want in Austin, we can get, like locations. Wow. He grew up there. And so he's like, we shoot at my mom's house. Well, like, you know, the Terrence Malick and Robert Rodriguez shoot there. There's an infrastructure for film. Richard Linklater, like, there's a great film community there. We can rent. And when we were shooting, nobody else was shooting in town. Those three guys weren't shooting anything. So it was like, we got good cameras and stuff. It was great. But then in shooting it, I had never done a feature like that before, but I'd gotten comfortable with the team at Vanishing Angle in doing shorts to make something that was a longer format. And I had done it as a podcast. I'd recorded the script as a podcast and then changed the script to make it work more in audio form. And then I just rehearsed the hell out of it over and over and over again and brutalized myself to make it any good. But all of it was building up to this last scene of me taking my daughter to the ballet, which is what my grandfather did to my mom, which got her into ballet, which we hear from my sister in this other scene. It's like, it was this wonderful, perfect circle about parenthood and life and legacy that the short has in it. And so, like, it made sense for me to make it this feature that went into that in greater detail about the next generation, about trying to get my daughter to like me again. And it was all of that, like, kitchen sink comedy that Mike Judge does so well in King of the Hill. It was, like, everything that I love to do. And then it's brutal watching it. It is such a sad movie, this poor guy. It's beautiful. I watch it now and I see it not as me with a mustache. I see it as this guy. I'm 4 years away from it. And now I'm like, I shouldn't have made it so sad. But that's the thing that people connect to. Roy Orbison made music for sad and lonely people, same with Bruce Springsteen. And it just made sense to make it this way. And then we submitted it. We shot it in November and we submitted it at like the late deadline for South by Southwest. And then I think on January 1st, South by reached out and said, yeah, we want to play it. So we wrapped on the 22nd, the 20th of November, and we had to screen it on March 6th or whatever.
So fast.
It sucked. So like there was a carpet like this. It's like a shag carpet. And it was in the loft at Vanishing Angle, and I would just sleep there. I was like,
were you editing it yourself?
Yeah. At that point, I was editing by myself. Brian Vannucci is like Will Smith's editor and did all of the Lil Dicky music videos. He's a good friend of ours, went to school with him. He's a very talented editor. And he came into AE, the assistant edit the movie, when we were in Austin. And he's great. Phenomenal job. And then I took over for the next few months to get it in tune for South By. And I just slept in the office. And we had a little heater. It was the winter in LA. And I was just like, all right, I'll just sleep here and do my work. And I had bad influences. It was like John Lasseter when they were doing Toy Story 2. The movie was supposed to come out on DVD with Disney, and they said, actually, it's going to be a theatrical release. And he's like, oh no, this has to be good. And so he slept under his desk for months at Pixar to make it any good. It's got to be good. Rewrote the movie, redid everything crazy. And so I channeled that. I was like, it's got to be done by this date. I don't know how to play a ukulele. I don't know how to play a field organ. I can like try and make these work because these are the instruments that I have. Yeah. Let's put in a soundtrack. And then that became the final cut of the movie. Crazy.
So when? How much time did you have to finish it? Like color and like
we had
sound
a week
design and stuff
in post. My buddy Danny Madden, who's a good friend from college and also a filmmaker, I was a producer for him for many years before I directed anything. Is a great sound designer. Jackie Zhu came on and they kind of tag team the mix. They would take different like reels of the movie and do the sound design for it, which is amazing. I was working on the edit and they were able to do that for me, which is such a gift. And then we went in and mixed it at our buddy Matt's house. Matt Yoakam, down the street from me, and he had like a little office that he could finish the movie in. And it was great. It felt like we were able to do it with our friends, and then it accidentally ends up on the world stage and being this indie hit or whatever.
Yeah.
It was very lo-fi. It was never, never clean. And then we started to grow to make things cleaner for Wolf of Snow Hollow. And then it was too clean. I was like, all right, let's go back to the garage. Let's keep making stuff.
Yeah. Interesting.
Lo-fi.
Do you feel like it'd be necessary, or would you tell somebody who's maybe has a short at TIFF or Sundance or whatever to be ready for a feature version of that short?
No, be ready for failure. Be ready to constantly be told that you're not good enough and that you suck and that there's other people out there that are going to sign contracts that you're uncomfortable signing, and like just be ready for FOMO and be okay with that. You have to be the studio. You need to treat your life like you are a YouTuber and that the industry is not going to support you. You have to create your own industry and your own audience that is going to give a shit about you and your movies. No one will care about your movie as much as you do. You should act that way. You should plan on self-distributing it. You should plan on having your own channel on YouTube, basically, except it happens to be iTunes or whatever. Like, that is the only way to survive in this industry and not be part of the revolving door and be booted out at the next film festival.
Walk me through the your distro process. So like from like day one, you lock the film. You're not taking on any sales agents.
We had no other option. My buddy Ben Wiesner, again, very lucky. We got Ben had been helpful in the sales world for many other films. He'd gone to Cannes a few times, Cannes Market, and then like made friends because he's just a lovely Appalachian producer, buddy of mine. And then we had enough contacts there that we could talk to five different distributors in France and pick the one who we actually love, who loves the movie, and have a bit of a bidding war, which is very rare. And he wasn't doing it in a way that a sales agent would. So like, let's say this, you finish the movie, it's 90 minutes. A lot of times people tell you have to go through these conventional channels to get onto platforms like iTunes or Amazon, or that if you were to do it yourself, it wouldn't be good enough. And that's how they make their jobs valuable, which is not true. You can do it yourself. You are good enough. And Ben was just willing to take that bet with me because he was a producer on the film as well. So let's say a distributor comes up to you and says, we'll pay you $10,000 upfront or $50,000 upfront for the rights of the movie that cost $190,000. Most sales agents would say, yep, I want that deal, because they're making a commission off of real money. Whereas Ben, my good buddy, has points on the back end of the movie and says, actually, I'm going to take this other deal that provides us with 30% of the streaming deal that you guys might make 6 months from now or 2 years from now. And we have made so much more money doing it that way instead of giving it to somebody who is in it for the short term.
Yeah.
It's been great.
So you guys aren't even looking for MGs necessarily. Like, that's not the
sometimes
the
no. value. Sometimes it'll be zero MG for a certain territory, but we get 50% of the theatrical ticket sales or whatever. And it's like, we know that we can make a certain amount from France because we won Deauville, or the Thunder Road feature had a great run in theaters there and people like us for whatever reason. And the same thing goes with many other territories. It's like, But again, it's not because we were established. Like, you could do all of this stuff on your own, and you can do it through social media. You can look up who distributed your favorite movie in France this year and then reach out and say, hey, can I send you a screener, and would you like to make an offer?
It still feels very daunting, but it's one of those things that's like...
It's crazy to me. I know you're right. I don't mean to interrupt. But literally every other aspect of filmmaking is daunting. And it's the one time that filmmakers go, you know what? I would like to be removed entirely from this property. Of like, they build a building. Yeah. They spend years of their lives building a building that they love, only to be completely removed from the ownership of the building because it's slightly daunting. Yeah. And it's like, anything, I don't mean to insult you on a podcast. I don't mean to jump your shit. I just encounter it every day. And I think that that is something, like, there are times where I'm on a call with a filmmaker for an hour and they're like, you're so right. This is great. And then I read in the trades that they signed a deal with some smaller distributor. Yeah. And it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah. I guess it's because of the, I don't know. It's one of those things that's like, do I take the risk of, because if it doesn't work, there's like a...
You take the risk anyway.
Yeah, no.
And the other thing is, when you sign with a smaller distributor, you're still going to be stuck working on the movie for the next 3 months. People are like, it takes up too much time. A lot of sales agents, the way that they get you is they'll say, oh, you shouldn't be focusing on this stuff. You should be focusing on your next movie. And that's how they very quickly remove you from your property. And it's not true. It really, if you even sell to a distributor, you're going to be spending the next month and a half doing deliverables of like every asset that they need and, you know, 5.1 surround sound and all of that stuff. The only difference is they're uploading it to their YouTube channel rather than your own.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make sense to me.
And taking a
all of the money.
All of the money.
All of the money.
So, did you do a lot of improv sort of growing up?
I hated it. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
Do you still hate it?
I still hate it. Yeah. I can't do it. I'm good at all of the like heavy rehearsal to do forensic comedy. I'm very lucky that Steve Coogan and I have become a little close since he loved the Thunder Road, all my movies. But to talk to him about it, he was like, it was a different kind of comedy. It was like heavy rehearsal to do theater pieces, basically. Yeah. It's like it has to be meticulously done, and there is a right way to tell a joke and a wrong way to deliver a joke. And inflection is so important on every word. It changes the context. I mean, like, I grew up watching Alan Partridge, and that was my favorite comedy. And as a producer, I was working at College Humor. It was a lot of improv performers. It was a lot of UCB performers. Yeah. And I never found it to be helpful. I never found it to be really funny, or that there was risk or anything.
Yeah.
It felt different from the stuff that I wanted to do.
Yeah. I get so jealous watching. I mean, it's also like, it's the same kind of jealousy that I have for like people who can just like rap, like just like improv and just rap real quick. Because I'm like, God, I feel like I'd be so cool if I could do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It is genetic, I think. It actually is like a skill that the brain works that way.
Yeah.
So don't feel bad.
Maybe just to close this out, do you have any funny stories from your days with Lil Dicky?
Oh my God, I got too many. Dave is really one of the reasons I have the work ethic that I have. Yeah. Of like, he at that time was so ambitious. I met Dave in 2014 when I moved to LA, and I wasn't supposed to produce his three music videos. I was supposed to like line producer help out, and then one of the producers dropped out, thank heavens. Yeah. And Tony, the director, Tony Ascenda, a good buddy of mine, was like, well, I guess this is your job now, you gotta do a thing. And so then I produced Let Me Freak, Classic Male Pregame, and Save That Money. Yeah. And all were very stressful and all were very low budget, but Dave, it just shines. He's just like such a wonderful, hilarious, authentic, and honest person. I mean, every moment we shot on Let Me Freak when he was fully nude, he would lean on me to be like, hey man, like, can we get people to sign NDAs? Like, can we do this? I was like, dude, I got you. Don't worry about it. Like, we would get, like, it was literally me and Tony and Alan Gwizdowski and Dave in the same room, cinematographer Alan. And we'd shoot it. He would get completely naked. And then just to humiliate himself, we went to the editor, Brian, and was like, we're going to blur it out, but it's got to be the smallest blur possible. So our buddy Brian had to go through and literally like frame by frame, he's like, Jesus Christ. And I was like, had to move so the dick was covered. It was so much fun. That was before motion tracking existed in Premiere. Yeah. But he was so leaning into the self-deprecation while also trying to do anti-rap and comedy rap better than the real rappers out there. And very much, I followed in those footsteps. Of a lot of my movies are parodies of genre, of like, you know, Wolf is No Hollow is Zodiac as a comedy.
That's so funny. I would have never said that, but it's so true.
And, yeah. Oh yeah. And then like, and then Beta Test is like, you know, Fatal Attraction as a comedy, or like 50 Shades of Grey as a directed little, by Ruben Ostlund or something.
It's also got a little like Eyes Wide Shut.
For sure. Bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in talking to Bill Hader's like Eyes Wide Shut is a comedy. Eyes Wide Shut totally. Is a deadpan comedy, and it's hilarious about this guy who's stressed out about his wife maybe fucking a sailor, and he's super stressed about it. It's really funny. And it's true. If you watch it that way, it's very funny. And you see the behind-the-scenes pictures of Stanley Kubrick, and everybody's laughing on set for this like super serious movie. It's probably a comedy. But yeah, no, all of my work, like Thunder Road, you could see as like Manchester by the Sea is a comedy. Like, we try to make something that is more fulfilling and potent to audiences who are looking for stuff like that. Like, Inside Out is one of my favorite movies of all time. It makes me laugh and cry every single time I watch it. Bing Bong's big scene, no spoilers, is unbelievable. And I realized that that is something that happens at the level of the brain. You can show an audience images and sound and get them to feel something that is magic and like a prescription drug or something. If you organize it in such a way, you can get anybody to feel something in their brain. And we've just raced at that.
Totally. Dude, I'm congrats on getting married.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming to sit with us. Take some time, just like chill out with your dream wife. I'm sure. I know you're acting right now, which is why your hair is red. I thought it was for me, but it's actually for a role.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I hope everything in the future goes smoothly.
Thank you. Likewise. Keep your fingers crossed for me.
Yeah. Next time on the Music Bed podcast, we talk with Brazilian director, DP, and photographer, Camila Cornelson.
I remember I was DPing for my partner, and when he was in the edit room, he told me my camera movement sucked. It was really bad.
This is your partner saying this?
Yes. And that was like heartbreaking in a sense, but at the same time was very good that someone close to you can be, you know, brutal, honest, and make you, you know, improve.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard of music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with another filmmaker you know, and subscribe to be notified for the next episodes.